Deke Slayton folded himself into the simulator and prepared to run the mission again. He had been training for nearly 3 years for a space launch, learning everything from orbital mechanics to survival techniques. Three of his fellows had already flown, but now, finally, it was nearly his turn to leave the Earth. It was to be another orbital mission, three revolutions around the planet, similar to the flight John Glenn had made earlier in the year. But though he wouldn't be the first American in orbit, he would still be among the first humans to reach space. It was the opportunity he had been waiting for. But as he ran the simulations and familiarized himself with the capsule that was to be his spacecraft, he couldn't know that it was all about to fall apart. Welcome to episode 14 of Frontier of Infinity, Aurora. In the previous episode, we flew with John Glenn as he became the first American in orbit. Today, we're going to check up on Wernher von Braun and his team, as well as the Manned Spacecraft Center, where work is continuing on the Moon Project. We'll also keep pushing forward with Project Mercury as the next American to orbit the Earth prepares to launch. But one of the Mercury 7 will have his plans utterly upended. Now, before we start back in on the story, I want to briefly mention something that some of you may have already noticed. In the first few episodes of this show, I mispronounced Maxime Faget's name. I looked up a pronunciation for it before I started recording, but alas, I was led astray. Suffice to say, the proper pronunciation is Faget, not Faget. So I'm sorry to any of you who've been pulling your hair out every time you've heard me mispronounce that name. But anyway, on to the show. 2 episodes ago, we discussed the mode decision which had come to dominate NASA's moon program. This was a debate regarding how a lunar mission should be structured. Wernher von Braun, as well as most of the senior engineers at NASA, were proponents of an Earth orbit rendezvous, by which 2 vehicles would be launched into orbit separately, where they would then dock and fly to the moon. The 2 joined halves would then descend to the moon together and lift off as 1 once the surface activities concluded. An engineer named John Hobalt had devised a different plan called a lunar orbit rendezvous. Under this plan, 1 rocket would launch 2 vehicles, 1 a landing craft and 1 a command module. They would fly to the moon, where the lander, being much smaller and lighter, would descend to the surface while the command module would stay in orbit. Once ready to depart, the lander would then reinsert itself into lunar orbit, where it would dock with the command module, and the command module's larger engine would push both vehicles back to Earth. This debate had caused much derision among the NASA designers, who initially condemned Hobalt's plan. But by the end of 1962, some of the seniors were beginning to come around to the idea. Robert Gilruth and Maxime Faget both came to realize that there really were sizable advantages to the LOR plan. It only required 1 launch vehicle, and prevented bringing the heavy equipment, engines, and fuel on the command module down to the lunar surface, where it would need to be lifted off again. The major holdout was von Braun. This ongoing debate was a serious detriment to the moon program. Until such time as an overall plan for the mission could be devised, design work on the vehicles required for it could not commence. However, from February through May of 1962, a series of meetings between the Manned Spacecraft Center and Von Braun's Marshall Space Flight Center were convened to argue the merits of the LOR plan. It had been determined that the LOR method could be pulled off with a single Saturn V launch vehicle firing in three stages. By June of 1962, after listening to his colleagues' arguments, and likely after running some calculations himself, Von Braun conceded that the LOR plan was the best option. Finally, the mode decision had been settled. Design work could begin in earnest on the lunar lander and its command module. But a moon landing was still years in the future, and Project Mercury yet had much to accomplish. In the twilight months of 1961, NASA had announced that Deke Slayton would fly the next mission after John Glenn's Mercury 6. His alternate was to be Wally Schirra. It was planned to be a second three-orbit flight, but this time with a stronger focus on science. Glenn had proven that the Mercury Atlas was capable of orbital flight, and he had performed some basic scientific tasks like tracking the spent Atlas core behind the capsule and making astronomical observations. But the uncertainty over the success of the flight, combined with the technical issues that had plagued it, had reduced its usefulness as a scientific endeavor. The next flight would not be so. There was a whole bevy of experiments and observations that the scientists on the ground wanted the next space pilot to perform. Deke was getting ready to launch. He had even named his capsule Delta 7. But then the bad news broke. Deke wouldn't be flying on Delta 7. In fact, he wouldn't be flying at all. If you recall from a while back, Deke Slayton had been diagnosed with a heart irregularity during the early phases of his training. Officially, it was labeled as idiopathic atrial fibrillation, but in layman's terms, his heart would occasionally beat irregularly. Deke had been checked out not only by the NASA flight surgeon, but also by a battery of the nation's top cardiologists. And while none of them could fix the issue, the general consensus had been that the condition was harmless and would not interfere with Slayton's ability to fly a spacecraft. After all, Deke had been piloting punishing aircraft for years before this point, and his heart had never given him any trouble. Since then, there were several additional studies into Deke's condition, but the consensus didn't change. However, there were a few doctors who reported that they could not be certain that Deke's heart wouldn't pose a potential risk on a space mission. And about 2 months shy of the launch of Delta 7, the higher-ups at NASA got nervous. They reasoned that if anything went wrong on the flight, even if it had nothing to do with his heart condition, it would reflect poorly on NASA if the word got out that they had let a man who was in less than peak condition fly into space. On the 15th of March, Deke was officially grounded. Not only from spaceflight, but from solo flights in high-performance jets as well. This was an unprecedented gut punch for Deke. He had fought through the gauntlet of selection tests and proven that he was among the best test pilots in the nation. He had sat through the briefings, participated in the trainings, dedicated himself fully to being one of America's first space travelers, only to have that dream ripped away from him at the last minute because some bureaucrats had gotten nervous. To make matters worse, Deke was expected to attend a press conference not long after he had received the news so he could explain his grounding to the public. Deke did all he could to stay calm and even-tempered during the briefing, but he did report later, quote, "I could have killed everyone in that room," end quote. It's not a stretch to say that Deke was enraged. But he was a team player as well. He and his fellow astronauts had become a tightly knit group, and his misfortune certainly wasn't their fault. He stated at the conference, quote, "I am disappointed, of course, but I will step aside as a flying astronaut and support the program in any way I can," end quote. Then another piece of upsetting news dropped. Instead of Wally Schirra, who had been training as Deke's alternate, Robert Gilruth decided that Scott Carpenter would make the flight instead. His reasoning was that Carpenter, having trained as Glenn's alternate, had more time in the simulator for this type of mission. He was simply better prepared. But Deke wanted Wally to fly in his stead. It was supposed to be Wally's mission if Deke couldn't go. But now a second astronaut was being cheated out of making the flight. Still, Deke kept cool and played along with what NASA wanted. He may have been grounded, but that status wasn't necessarily permanent. He was still in the astronaut corps. There was a chance that one day, the powers that be would change their minds and he'd still be able to venture into space. But if he ever wanted that distant hope to become a reality, he'd have to cooperate. Even so, when Carpenter's flight finally lifted off on May 24th, Deke was positioned in a remote tracking station in Australia, almost as if NASA didn't want to risk him making trouble in the States during the flight that should have been his. Carpenter had renamed Delta 7 to Aurora 7, signaling the dawn of a new age. Like always, it was slightly different from the other capsules that had flown, perhaps most notably the heavy flight path indicator, which displayed the capsule's position over the Earth, had been removed, as it had not proven to be sufficiently useful for the weight penalty it incurred. After a delay due to ground fog, the Atlas rocket fired its engines and began its ascent. Once in orbit, Carpenter set to work spinning the capsule around to point the heat shield in the direction of travel, doing so manually with the fly-by-wire control mode as opposed to allowing the automatic system to do it as Glenn had done. With Carpenter at the controls, this maneuver consumed only a third of the fuel that it had on Glenn's flight. Carpenter then had a little trouble loading some specialized film into his camera, which he was supposed to use to photograph the horizon. And then he found that astronomical observations for the purposes of navigation were difficult to make, as the interior of the capsule was too bright. In a repeat of one of the experiments conducted during Glenn's flight, a flare was fired off from a ship down below. But just like last time, clouds occluded the light, and Carpenter could not make it out from the capsule. During his second orbit, he performed a number of maneuvering tests, even rolling the capsule inverted so that his head was pointed down toward the Earth to see if he could remain properly oriented. He then pointed the capsule's nose down and reported that the view was fantastic. But among all of these maneuvers, fuel was beginning to go more quickly than was comfortable. Six times, Carpenter accidentally activated the double authority control, whereby both the manual and automatic control systems were active simultaneously. By the end of his second orbit, his fuel reserves in both the automatic system and the manual system were down to just over 40%, and control urged him to manage his fuel more carefully during the third orbit. Eventually, he had to enter into free drift mode to conserve fuel. An hour and 38 minutes into the mission, Carpenter was ready for another experiment. He was to release a colored balloon from a compartment in the capsule's nose, now pointed away from the direction of travel, which would trail out behind the capsule attached to a line. The point was to collect data on atmospheric drag and color visibility, but the balloon didn't inflate properly, and the colors were barely visible. Still, it managed to turn up some data on atmospheric drag, but did not jettison as planned, and instead clung to the capsule throughout the third orbit as it became wrapped around the antenna casing at the front of the spacecraft. The flights of Aurora 7 also brought the return of an old mystery. Each time Carpenter would enter into a sunrise, he would see the same golden motes that John Glenn had spotted on his flight, the little fireflies that had shown up around his capsule until the light grew to a sufficient intensity to make them vanish. At first, Carpenter was at a loss for what they were, just as Glenn had been. But during his third orbit, he reached over toward his densitometer, a machine for measuring light intensity, just as he was coming up on a sunrise, when his hand impacted the capsule's bulkhead. As soon as this happened, a fresh wave of lighted flecks stirred outside the window. Intrigued, Carpenter gave the wall another rap, and another cloud of pixies went billowing by. This accident revealed the true identity of the fireflies. The outside of the capsule was coated in frost. Moisture inside the capsule was shunted out of the spacecraft through a vent on the vehicle's side. Once exposed to space, these water droplets would freeze, some of which wound up clinging to the side of the capsule. The slightest disturbance would jostle some of these particles free, where they would float around the spacecraft, shining in the light of the sun as it peeked up over the horizon. Shortly after the Firefly mystery was solved, it was about time for Aurora 7 to return to the Earth. The Hawaii ground station instructed Carpenter to switch to the automatic stabilization and control system, but when he did so, the system did not properly maintain the 34-degree pitch angle and 0-degree roll angle that was required for reentry. Carpenter tried to determine the cause of the problem, but time was growing short. He switched to the fly-by-wire control mode, but did not switch off the manual mode. Now the capsule was consuming fuel from both systems. Carpenter fought to align the capsule properly, but then the automatic reentry system didn't fire the retro rockets. Carpenter manually fired them himself, but he had made a mistake in aligning the capsule. His yaw angle was misaligned by 25 degrees to the right. This wasn't a fatal error, but it did mean that the capsule's trajectory no longer matched the flight plan. He was going to come down off target. To exacerbate the issue, the retro rockets had fired a handful of seconds late, and their thrust output had been about 3% below normal. These would also contribute to the course deviation. The capsule began to oscillate as it fell, and Gus Grissom called over the radio to remind Carpenter to close his helmet visor. He ran out of fuel during the descent and had to sit tight while the capsule began to exhibit wild pendulum motions. But it wasn't enough to cause any critical problems, and the parachute deployed as planned. Carpenter activated the landing bag and braced for splashdown. Once in the ocean, the capsule listed heavily to one side for a moment, and Carpenter noticed a few drops of water on some of the instrumentation. He wondered for a moment if Aurora 7 was going to go the same way as the Liberty Bell had, but luckily, it didn't flood. Carpenter was well aware that he had come down quite a way off course. Gus Grissom had informed him during his descent that it was likely going to take the recovery team at least an hour to reach him. Regardless, he called out over the radio to see if anyone was receiving, but no one responded. It was at that point that Carpenter noticed the capsule was sitting low in the water. He couldn't use the explosive hatch lest the Aurora flood and sink like the Liberty Bell had. So that left him with only one option for egress. He'd have to crawl out through the narrow escape hatch at the top of the capsule. Lugging his camera, inflatable raft, and survival gear alongside the hoses connected to his suit, Carpenter slowly wormed his way up and out of the nose of the capsule. Once his head breached the hatch, he braced himself on his elbows for a moment to rest and disconnected himself from the capsule. When he was finally free of the tiny spaceship, he slid down its flank into the water, where he inflated his raft and scrabbled aboard. His recovery beacon was active, squawking out his location, and a dose of green dye had bloomed out into the water from the capsule to make him easier to spot from the air. Finally, a handful of aircraft drew into view, where they spotted Carpenter leisurely drifting on the ocean's surface. Two observer aircraft and then two cargo aircraft began to circle overhead, and a couple of divers descended from one of the helicopters. They swam over to Carpenter's boat, where he offered them some food from his survival pack. They politely declined, but did use a flotation collar dropped from one of the nearby aircraft to help stabilize the capsule until the main recovery unit could arrive on scene. Carpenter was flown to the USS Farragut, where he received the now customary phone call from President Kennedy. Kennedy was quite relieved that Carpenter was safe. From the point of view of the rest of the world, there was no guarantee that Aurora 7 had survived the descent. Carpenter assured Kennedy that he was fine and said that he was sorry for, quote, not having aimed better during the landing, end quote. Upon debriefing, Carpenter had a number of notes for future missions. The first thing he noticed was that every task he had been assigned had taken more time than had been allocated. Even loading film into a camera was a difficult task in microgravity and while wearing a spacesuit. He further noted that the final flight plan for the mission had not been made available until right before the launch was to take place. Carpenter argued that the finalized version of the flight plan should be ready to go at least 2 full months before the launch. Aurora 7's flight had been a success, even despite the off-target landing. Carpenter had managed to get more done scientifically than Glenn had, marking his flight as the most scientifically productive of Project Mercury so far. The Americans now had 2 orbital flights under their belt. The mode decision had been settled, and work on Project Apollo could begin in earnest. The Americans have been making steady progress throughout the first half of 1962. But things have been largely quiet on the Soviet side of the equation. Next time, we'll check in on Sergei Kurilyov and his team. They've been watching the Americans with great interest, and Kurilyov will be tasked with launching a mission to ensure that their lead in the space race remains durable. Before we sign off today, I want to quickly share a piece of exciting news with you all. This podcast now has an Instagram account. Now, for those of you who've been listening from the beginning, you'll know that I'm not terribly comfortable with social media. I've spent most of my life actively avoiding it. But luckily, a valued friend of mine has offered to help me navigate this bold new frontier. So I'm hoping that I'll be able to use this Instagram account to add a visual dimension to the show, posting photographs of the astronauts and the rockets that they fly and all that sort of thing. So, if you're interested in taking a look at that account, it is titled FOI Spacecast, just like the Twitter account. So, take a look if you want. Thanks. As always, thanks to all of you for listening. If you like this show and you want to help me out, please follow the podcast, share it with your friends and your family, and give it a rating if you feel so inclined. It really does help. Our theme music is Crossing the Universe by Esther Garcia. You can listen to the full track and more of her music on Spotify. Until next time, I'm Tom. This is Frontier of Infinity. I'll see you among the stars.